Hello and welcome back to Render Unto Caesar on 91.3 FM CJTR Community Radio. I'm your host, Josh Campbell. Render Unto Caesar seeks to explore the connection between religion and the public sphere. The title comes from one of the more well-known events in Jesus' life, when he gets asked if a devout Jew should pay taxes to Rome. Jesus says, "Render unto Caesar what is Caesar's, and unto God what is God's." Previously on Render Unto Caesar, I talked with Stan Goff, a retired Delta Force soldier in the U.S. Army. Stan and I chatted about his extensive military experiences, including one in Haiti, where he went through a profound paradigm shift. In today's show, we go from talking about Stan's military career to his movement into Christianity. Later in the show, we talk about his book, Mammon's Ecology. We end today's show with a discussion on the radical reforms needed to get our economies and our planet out of the mess we're in. This will be part two of a three-part series. Thanks for listening. So I'm just curious, Easter 2008, I was baptized. Can you talk me a bit through this? How did it come about that you you got baptized there, and I mean that you became Christian?
Yeah, it's kind of hard to describe. You know, because a lot of what happens in the conversion is kind of indescribable anyway. But I think I needed to be knocked down so I could pay attention. And around 2006, I had completely flamed out. We'd been going like 1,000 miles an hour on the anti-war movement for since September 2001. I actually became active right there. Well, I was already politically active, but when you're retired military and against the war, all of a sudden your voice is in demand to contribute to a movement, and it's not natural for me. I'd much prefer to isolate. You know what I mean? And I'd rather go fishing or something. But it seemed like it was necessary. But it was a lot of work and a lot of travel, a lot of waking up and can't remember where I am, and then just the emotional burnout, especially toward the end there, because I was working with a lot of young veterans. And we'd put together Iraq Veterans Against the War up in Philadelphia, and we were working a lot with them by then. And it causes you to revisit a lot of stuff, and you end up, you know, I don't know. I say it was emotionally, it was tough, and I started kind of coming apart in some ways. I started having psychological issues around 2006. And the last thing that I did in 2006 was we organized a six-day march from Mobile, Alabama to New Orleans to combine the post-Katrina Gulf Coast with the anti-war movement, in a sense. And that was very emotionally draining. It's kind of hard to describe that. It's 6 days on the road with a bunch of people, and I was the lead organizer. So it was kind of like, I don't know, it was a lot of work, but again, it was a lot of, it was an emotional roller coaster. I was already on, what the hell was the name of it? I forgot the name of it. They had to be on some drug to keep me from, you know, killing myself or others or whatever. That's hyperbole, but it was one of those. With it. I can't even remember what it was now. After organizing the Gulf March in 2006, I just completely flamed out. And I had turned inward, and like I say, I'd been exposed to a lot of, Quakers, activist Quakers, and a lot of Catholic workers in conjunction with political work for several years, and also a lot of black clerics. In fact, I was working with William Barber before he became the big thing, because he was from Eastern North Carolina. That's where we were. He was working closely with Black Workers for Justice on the UE 150 union organizing campaign, and I was up to my neck in that when I was there. So I didn't have the kind of prejudices against people of faith that a lot of people who are coming out of a kind of an agnostic space like I was do have. In fact, I was always kind of surprised by the level of commitment some of these people demonstrated, especially the Catholic workers, because they had lived their entire lives, morning, noon, and night, doing both hospitality and activism. And I was very impressed by that. I've always been a voracious reader, I had started, you know, reading the stuff like Cross and stuff on historical Jesus and whatnot, which is, you know, I have a critique in reverse right now of that as someone who's a Christian. But it was a good gateway for someone who was still sort of in that historical critical episteme then, you know what I mean? I was always, you know, as someone who's coming out of a Marxist milieu, it was easy. That fit easily within that sort of historical materialist framework, especially contextualizing first century Palestine with what the situation actually was there with the Roman occupation, that, you know, all that. But then I'm not sure at what point I started feeling pulled in, but some people from Duke University probably had a lot to do with that. And that would be, when I first decided to join a church, my pastor had been a student of Stanley Hauerwas, and he took me over and introduced me to Stanley. And so I just like consumed everything that Stanley Hauerwas had written. And, but also, you know, at the post-conversion, I still had the Duke connection, still do, just because I lived 30 minutes away from Duke, for one thing. But Amy Laura Hall, who's still teaching over there, and Kara Slade, who I guess is the chaplain at Princeton University now, she was a student there. And so there's some, I can't, like, say, you know, this was my Damascene moment. But I will say I would never go back. two things that were kind of missing from my life when I was starting to hit that sort of burnout point was that I really needed were hope and forgiveness. And you don't hear a lot about that among political types. You know, they're always, a lot of times it's all about, you know, ramping up the outrage and you know, mobilizing everybody to some kind of a fight and whatnot. I don't know. I think maybe I just, the seeds were probably planted a long time ago. I mean, I was raised for a period of time as a Seventh-day Adventist, of all things. It didn't last until I was about 11 or 12 years old. But I'd been exposed to people of faith. And then I was, for the short period of time that I was in college, in my first break in service, when I got back from Vietnam and I took a break, and then went, before I went back in the Army, I was in college for a little bit. And I was an English major. And I had to, in order to read and understand things like Shakespeare, Chaucer, you name it, Dostoevsky, it didn't matter, you know, any kind of literature that you're reading, you can't get a handle on it until you have some sort of a kind of framework of understanding of what people were like back then, because they were distinctly different people. And one of the things that had always kind of fascinated me since then was, how would you put this? It's kind of the architectonics of medieval scholasticism. And the thing that stuck with me, I had a professor named Frank Reuter when I was going to University of Arkansas in Monticello, who probably had the best description of what Christianity was for someone like me at the time that stuck with me. And he said, Christianity is about God crashing through infinity to become one of us. And I don't know, that just it really communicated with me. And then at some point when I was, 55, 56 years old, I really needed God to crash through infinity and become one of us.
Mm-hmm. Stan, thanks. At what point did you connect with Ched Myers?
So, well, it was when I had joined the Methodist Church, and Greg Moore was my pastor, but I had a friend who I'd been involved in activism with, Barbara Zelter, for a long time, and she knew Ched, and she and another guy, Steve, knew Ched, and Steve, I'm trying to think, I'm having a mental block here. Steve was from Lumberton, North Carolina, and he had gone to one of Ched's things. And through the Methodist conference there, somebody set it up for me to go attend one of his one-week-long seminars on Mark. So I went out to the Ojai Valley for a week, and it was great. It was great. I mean, we spent a week and never even got through Mark in a week. I mean, it was that intense, but I like that kind of stuff. I'm not big on kind of the new way, you know, I'm an old school guy. You know, I can sit through a lecture. I prefer a lecture to any other form of teaching because it allows someone to get all their stuff in one place, make it coherent, and then I can receive it in its full coherence and then process it for a while and see what I think about it. But I know it's in a lot of people now, they want something that's supposed to be more participatory and all that kind of stuff. And I say, nah, I'm going to go sit at the feet of a master for a while until I know as much as he or she does. And then I'll get creative with it. You know what I mean? That's just kind of my own way of doing things. But I was just blown away. And I've got my copy of Binding the Strong Man around here somewhere, which I go back and refer to frequently. In fact, it was the reference to Jesus' confrontation with the Pharisees over taxes that I used in Mammon's Ecology was taking that five-piece framework about how each of these incidents took place was taken straight from Ched's analysis. And by now, I think, in fact, it's probably, I got it, I don't know where I got the book around here. But yeah, and I still go back to that. Carolina, and then we ended up together in Adrian, Michigan, a town of 20,000 souls. So, yeah.
Stan, I was going to ask you just that your movement, you know, into Christianity from, Marxism. I mean, Marx is often quoted as saying, you know, religion is the opiate of the masses. And I'm curious, you know, has that been, have you had that criticism of the church, or in some ways can it be a smelling salt yeah. instead of an opiate?
It's a misinterpreted quote from Marx that's taken out of context a lot of times. So I do want to qualify that. I'm definitely not agreeing with Marx on this, but the interpretation, because when he said that, the opiates were used as painkillers routinely, the same way that we use aspirin or Tylenol right now, you know, for aches and pains and whatnot. And what Marx said was that it was the sigh of the oppressed. And basically, if he translated it today, it would mean religion is the aspirin of the peoples. You know what I mean? It's not like it was something to bewilder people. It was or to make them high or incoherent. It was something to relieve their pain. Now, does religion, I have an issue with that term, but I'm not going to get off in a bunch of stuff about that. But does religion work that way? Sure. It works that way for a lot of people. For a lot of people, it's just a get out of jail free card for death. I mean, it doesn't entail any obligations or responsibilities in the present. You just sort of go check the box and, you know, show up once a week at church and do your tithe, and then you cash out after you die. But that's not all it is. That's not all it's ever been. In fact, it didn't get separated out and become religion as opposed to something else until really late modernity. There was no distinction between, say, politics and religion prior to modernity, like Marx, Freud, Nietzsche. No, I think Nietzsche is a cheap ripoff of Kierkegaard myself.
we'll come back to that, Stan. I have some more questions kind of around that. I want to hop into the tribute episode text. So a common thing that you hear, I know one of my guests in my second episode, we were talking about the tribute to Caesar episode, and you know, he sent me that reading, and he just said, well, Jesus is a great thinker, but he's not a revolutionary. He doesn't inspire rebellions. You turn the other cheek. And it's interesting, I was reading a bit of Marcus Borg, and I know a friend of mine has been reading Reza Aslan's book. And so you have these opposite poles of, you know, Jesus was not a revolutionary, just a spiritual leader. And then you have other authors who are saying he was a revolutionary. And, Borg was saying, in between those is this nonviolent resistance to domination, system, you know. And I'm just wondering, you mentioned in your book that the church has an obsession with respectability. And I don't know if there's a way you can tie some of those things together in a response of some sort to what I just said.
Yeah. A lot of, excuse me, a lot of my old leftist friends like to say things like Jesus was a socialist. You know, that's become kind of a little truism, and I have to remind them that socialism as an idea or a reality didn't exist back then. It would have been, you know, again, it's sort of anachronism that people use. I think a lot of that is, again, this anachronistic retrojection of current day concepts on events and phenomena from the past. Sure, Jesus was a revolutionary in the same sense that, say, someone like Yoda or Hauer was, would say. But that revolution was not, it wasn't the Bastille. You know, it wasn't the Winter Palace. It wasn't anything like that. It had nothing to do with that. It had to do with the announcement of that Jesus didn't really want people to rebel, and you know, and Romans 13 is the other one that you get along with the misinterpretation of the coin. Strangely enough, Paul, who wrote Romans, was crucified. So, and so was Peter. So were all of them. And that's conveniently left out whenever people start saying, you know, well, Jesus was saying, you know, be respectable, or however it is that people want to interpret that.
So you think that Jesus was saying pay your taxes, or what?
Jesus was saying pay your taxes. Jesus didn't say any such thing, and it completely ignores the context of the whole thing. But I'm sure, I'm assuming anyway, that people who are watching this probably already have a handle on the whole story about the denarius and Tiberius's face stamped on there and all that. On the respectability thing, it's kind of interesting. When I wrote
Stan, if I can just stop you there. Actually, I haven't really walked the viewers through this, so I wouldn't assume that. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I mean, okay. Well, a denarius is it was a coin. It was a day's wages if you were working for the Romans. It was a Roman coin. It was stamped with the image of Tiberius Caesar, and it said Tiberius Caesar. And the translation roughly is son of God. Now, this contrast comes up before in a couple places. First of all, it comes up when Jesus is baptized, because the symbol of the king, or the symbol of the Caesar, it shows up above the Caesar is an eagle. And then what shows up above Jesus is a dove. That contrast is intentional. And then it shows up again when he enters into Jerusalem in the final week, because on that day, every year, Passover was whenever Jewish rebels sort of started running out of control. And so Pilate, or whoever the came before him, would have a Roman military parade to sort of stomp through the streets and let everybody know how powerful they are as a method of deterrence, and you know, showing themselves off and puffing out their chests and whatnot. And then Jesus comes riding in on a donkey colt. That's political parody. So you got it with his baptism, and then you have it again here, and then now he comes up to the coin, and it's stamped with Tiberius Caesar, son of God. And what gets ignored is this whole incident was an attempt to get him killed, because on the one hand, he's got a popular base that's following him around right now that is not particularly fond of the Romans and not particularly fond of Judean colonial surrogates either, whether they be Pharisees or scribes or Sadducees. And they want to destroy his credibility with his base, but they also want to get him in trouble with the Roman authorities. And it says in there, the word they use in there is a word that says trapped. They set a trap for him. And the trap was to get him in between these two groups and say, you know, should you pay your taxes? They don't present him with a coin. He asked for the coin. And then when he asked for the coin, he looks at it and he says, whose image is on it? And this all gets left out. All they say is render unto Caesar what is Caesar's. But that's not exactly what he says. The term render, and this is something that Chad showed me, he actually reads some Greek and I don't, it was not render, it was repay. It really meant repay. As a quick side, I don't want to distract myself, but if you haven't seen David Bentley Hart's translation of the New Testament, fantastic. Yeah, it's as literal word by word. So he really preserves the kind of vernacular flavor of the language and everything. It's almost like a flashback reading. It's wonderful. Yeah. But anyway, what Jesus ends up saying is, repay to Caesar what is Caesar's, and repay to God what is God's. But what Jesus is saying, I don't really care about this coin. That coin was despised by Judeans. It's what you get paid in, and you got to get paid. In fact, Jesus may have been paid in that, because there's every indication that he was probably a tecton working in Sepphoris, 4 miles away from Galilee, from Nazareth, which wasn't really a carpenter. It was usually more of a construction worker. So, and a lot of that was stonemasonry. But at any rate, I'm getting off on one of my tangents again. But Judeans had a prohibition against graven images. And here's a coin with a graven image of a guy who's a military occupier. So it was despite, that was the reason there were money changers in the court outside the temple, because they had to exchange those for shekels so that you wouldn't be transporting graven images into the temple. So, I mean, that context is completely lost. You see, what he's doing is he's getting out of the trap by, I don't know. He's got. He does that over and over again. He avoids falling into the trap, but then he answers their question in a way that embarrasses them. And this is a theme throughout Mark and the other Gospels as well. But yeah, it's not about paying taxes. In fact, if you read, and this is where Illich kind of helped me out. There's another one here. Anybody hadn't read that there? Rivers North of the Future. That's probably the closest to a theological work that Illich ever did. But he said, you know, when you read Jesus' words, compare him with his action and put it in historical context, what Jesus says is if you worship money, you worship power. And if you worship power, you worship the devil. When Jesus is tempted, he's tempted with three things. And every one of those things are the exercise of power. You see what I'm saying? If you turn the rocks into bread, so you can keep the, you know, you can keep the peasants calm. You can be thrown over the wall, which is a kind of, and nothing will happen. So you have impunity. You'll be able to command. So these are all aspects of power, and they're all being offered by the tempter, you know, in the vernacular, the devil. So that's kind of the whole thesis behind mammon's ecology, where it really is, and I think Chet had a good word for it. He said, I was trying to do a workbook that showed the inner life of money and why it can't be controlled. But money now, this is even more pertinent, this idea that worship money, you worship power, worship power, you worship the devil. It's even more pertinent now in a capitalist milieu, because we've all become 100% life and death dependent on money. In vernacular subsistence cultures, money was unnecessary or only marginally necessary because people provisioned themselves.
Hello, folks, and thank you for listening to Render Unto Caesar on 91.3 FM CGTR Community Radio. I'm your host, Josh Campbell. Render Unto Caesar seeks to explore the connection between religion and the public sphere. If you're just joining us now, I'm chatting with former Special Forces soldier Stan Goff about a paradigm shift he went through during his time in the U.S. military. While Stan participated in many different operations throughout his career, it was his stint in Haiti in the 90s that really changed him. In the second half of this show, I asked Stan to talk about his book Mammon's Ecology and the radical reforms needed to solve today's problems. Thanks for listening.
So coming back to, respectability, I kind of cut you off at that point, the church.
I wrote a whole chapter in Borderline about respectability. One of the things, this is where the church keeps going wrong, where the churches keep going wrong, is they keep wanting to align themselves with power. And they've gotten into that habit ever since Constantine. The problem was when the power centers broke up prior to, during, and after the Reformation, then they all, you had Christians out there telling other Christians that you could go to heaven for killing Christians. And but respectability was really a thing. Respectability as such. Now, there are analogs to respectability when you go back and look at, I hate to crack on the Pharisees too much because that gets interpreted the wrong way. I think Jesus was really asking the Pharisees to be more Pharisaic in a sense. He wasn't saying that they were bad because they were Pharisees. He was saying they're bad because they were hypocrites. there's an analog there about, what is considered respectable. But when it's built into a caste system, it's a little bit different than what we see with the kind of respectability we see now, which is something that sort of really took hold only in the 19th century. And it's almost a consumer product. And this had to do with, there were bourgeois gender conventions were built around this. Was the home was the woman's realm, and the public sphere was the man's realm, and respectability was turned into kind of a cult. And it still exercises a lot of power. In fact, one of the things that tends to hold back, in my opinion, the struggles of a lot of subaltern groups in capitalist society is that there are always a few people who believe that by imitating the standards of respectability of the dominant culture, they'll be accepted into the dominant culture. And this is the critique that people coming from the black radical tradition have of sort of bourgeois black politics, for example, is that there's this urge toward respectability with the mistaken belief that by achieving the standards of respectability, that people will be inclusive, because they've ignored the material conditions that reproduce themselves and give rise to these relations in the first place. But yeah, respectability, it's an insipid and insidious, because it tends to become an idol.
And I know you mentioned, speaking of idols, I found it interesting, Stan, when you talked about, seeing the national flag in a church, that was interesting. I mean, this whole tie to nationalism within Christianity, can you speak to that at all?
I speak to nationalism all the time. It's my whole shtick has been anti-militarism, and I mean, that's nationalism. There's an American church. I mean, I don't know about, I can't speak for Canada. I've gone up there to visit briefly a couple of times, but I know very little about Canada, apart from the fact that the pictures of it are very pretty in some places. And I'd love to fish up there. I do like the fish.
I would tell you that, I have some pretty strong conservative Christian background, and a lot of my friends in that world, strong faith is synonymous with devotion to the Canadian flag and Canadian.
Okay, then you've got the same thing. For a time, I'm sure that was true of say Catholicism when it was aligned with Napoleon's, nation state making project, for example. There's one example, but where to begin. I mean, you could write volumes on this. And it's, for some reason, it's invisible to people. It's invisible to people because we've been inundated with nationalism almost as if it's an ontological fact. You know what I mean? There's God, there's nation, there's the family, you know, in that order.
Well, Stan, I just wanted to interject there. I'll give you a bit of a scenario. I'd love to hear your comment on it. So a few years ago, I was teaching in a science class, and one of the outcomes was to talk about the impacts of energy infrastructure and industry on the environment. Right. And one of my good friends, she's a very strong Indigenous activist here in my city. And I brought her in to speak, and we were nearing the 150 year anniversary of Canada. And the first thing she did when she spoke is she said, I'm not celebrating that. In fact, I'm lamenting that. And she talked about that. And I think her presentation, I mean, she had been to Standing Rock and she had done a lot of these things, and she was telling my students about it. And I remember, these are great, you know, these are grade nine students, freshman high school students. And one of the boys in the class was like, Mr. Count, he was so upset. He said, my grandfather fought for this country, and to have her come in here and say that she doesn't even recognize our anniversary, that's insulting to me and my family. And I just couldn't believe the strong reaction from some of these high school kids, you know, particularly the white males, right? And I don't know, you know, as someone who has military background like yourself, and you know, to have, I wonder if you could comment that. There just seems to be so much tied into all of that with nationalism, you know?
Yeah. Well, again, the danger of reification, but because nationalism is a lot of things. It's there. We know it's there. Don't really know where all the boundaries are on it, because it's insinuated itself into every nook and cranny of culture. And our own psyches. It's you know what I mean? It's just sort of an autonomic response, because we're indoctrinated with it from very early on. That indoctrination is even more efficient. The more efficient the communications technology tends to become. I don't even know where to start. I think you just have to challenge it and tell people, suffers some sort of an epistemic jolt. You know what I mean? It takes a shock, a little bit of trauma of some kind to help people get past these kinds of indoctrination. I mean, you know, indoctrination is part of life. I mean, we're all going to be indoctrinated into a culture and whatnot. But nationalism is dangerous, because it's dangerous in two directions. It's dangerous in one direction, in particular talking about the United States now, because it's the foundation of our extreme militarism. And it's dangerous in the other direction, because it gives people a point to unite around that causes things like class to disappear, you know. So it undermines essential solidarities, and then it creates a form of solidarity that's projected into militarism.
Would you say
how to begin to unravel that? I don't know. I think it's just have to challenge people. Lowe's department store is a big box store here for, like, you probably got it up there too, right?
We have. Yeah. There's one in my city too.
You want to do construction projects or fix it up stuff, and you go to Lowe's, right? Well, they've got a 10% discount for retired military. So I use my 10% discount. I'm going to take that money any way I can get it. You know what I mean? But then they forced their employees to say thank you for your service. It's just something they have to say. And that annoys me because I don't think we'll be telling employees to say stuff like that. Not just that because it offends me, but just, you know, this is just another example of how, you know, your employer owns your ass. It can even make you say what you don't want to say, you know.
Would you say,
when they say thank you for your service, what I tell them every time is say, don't thank me because all I did was make war on poor people. That's all I say. And it's a lot of times you don't get anything but silence in response. But hopefully, because that was probably a little jarring to hear.
Just to give the listener some context here, I this is kind of the part of your book where you subscribe some possible solutions for how we ease into more of that subsistence living rather than go to it through a forced disastrous path. A couple of things I wanted to, you know, you mentioned the word triage a couple times in your book, and we're kind of, we're kind of at this point of triage, and it's interesting. I don't know if you're familiar with an author. His name's John Madai. It's
M-A-D-I-L-L-E?
John Madai.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's a Facebook friend.
Yeah.
Yeah, so yeah.
I when you mentioned triage in your book a couple times, you know, like I'll just share one quote here from Mammon's Ecology. You can call it whatever you like, but the central state would quickly need to take control over productive processes as a form of triage. New social organizations cannot be created by decree or wholesale abandonment of current systems. If there's a resolution to our crisis, then it will take more than a generation. It will require complex, detailed, and carefully thought out transitions. When I said triage, I meant exactly that. Such a movement would have to stop the bleeding and restore the airway first. And that would mean a strong, nonviolent state that does several specific things as soon as possible. And I guess my question there, and I'll come back to John Madai, he talks about kind of the exact same thing. Yeah. But I know and we touched on this already, Stan, but with a lot of Christians, you know, for some reason, you know, whenever they hear strong state and socialism, I would say more, you know, there's a lot of fear and intrepidation and a lot of reaction there. Why do you think that is? It exists in the church?
Scale. We've created problems on such a scale, and they become so universalized that finding a way to back out of them is going to require solutions on the same scale to get us back down to smaller scales. And scale itself is a problem. The more people you have, I have no idea how China does what China does, but I know they couldn't do it without the level of authoritarianism that they have right now. Now, I'm not saying we should emulate China, but I'm saying when you got 1.3 billion people and you got to make sure that they're all fed, you construct systems that can't be sustained into perpetuity. None of this stuff can be sustained into perpetuity. China looks like it's really strong right now, but China's very weak. We're all weak in a sense. I mean, you think about 300, whatever it is, I had to put the population of 328 million people in the U.S. now, something like that. 328 million people, a lot of people. It's not India, but it's a lot of people. And if they're all suffering from the same systemic problem, then it's going to take a systemic solution to fix it. And the only body, the only accountable body to do that is the state. And, you know, maybe I've been calling myself a socialist for so long that people start to think that it's like, you know, it's like my identity or something like that. That's not it at all. I'd be happy to just, you know, dispense with all of it. And I'd certainly dispense with the word. If you can, people call it a rubber duck if you want to. But we need the state to get involved because, number one, because of the scale of the problems that we're confronting right now. And number two, because of the scale of power that's going to have to be confronted to get the job done. No one but the state. The state is the only entity that potentially has any accountability at all that can confront the power now of capital. Transnational capital has become more powerful than most states. Now, it's not coherent, and there's a huge contradiction there. The contradiction is one that Harvey pointed out, is that you still have the contradiction between that national boundary and the transnational nature of capital right now, which gives the state, oddly enough, an edge, because the state still does exercise sovereignty within its own boundaries. And so the state still does have the potential to confront capital where it need be. And that's especially true of the kind of what we need right now is something that's going to give everybody some breathing space and then create spaces within which people can exercise their own creativity on a more local level to solve their own problems. But the big things are we need to make sure that everybody's employed, fed, and able to go to the doctor, just for starters. And to reduce people's dependency on money, if you can't get rid of money itself, then you have to make sure that everybody has enough money so they can say no to capital.
Right. I was wondering on this note, Stan, if you're familiar with modern monetary theory.
Yeah.
Yeah. I know this is something that, you know, Madai's book, there's just this one section where it's interesting because he talks like you that, you know, ideally we need to get, I would say his book, the prognosis he subscribes is probably three things, a collection of Georgism, just kind of a single payer tax, distributism, which is, you know, kind of based on more small business subsidiarity.
Yeah, K. Chesterton thing.
Yeah. And then he also has modern monetary theory. And the reason he says, you know, we need these smaller subsidiary economies, but we're not going to, like, if we just go to that, we're going to kill the patient. So that's where modern monetary theory comes in. I'm curious, you know, what are your thoughts on that? This whole idea, I mean, modern monetary, just for listeners who haven't heard about it.
Have you ever seen a movie called Matewan? John Sayles movie about union organizing in West Virginia?
No, what's it called? Brilliant
film. Matewan, Matewan. Wonderful John Sayles film. Classic. It's about a coal war that happened in West Virginia, but there's a quote in there where he's talking to some union people about why they shouldn't go to war with the bosses and why they have to be careful. He said, "We're in a hole full of coal gas here, and one spark could set it off. So we got to chip away very carefully." That's the way I feel about what has to happen. It doesn't have to happen. Everything could go to shit in a handbasket, but it needs to happen. Modern monetary theory, I think in Mammon's Ecology, I came out against it without ever knowing what it was when I wrote Mammon's Ecology. Now that I've looked into it, I think modern monetary theory could work in the United States for a short period of time. But the only reason it can work here is because we have a seigniorage currency. Every problem associated with it's going to be exported back onto people somewhere else. And so we're back into this core periphery dynamic or core subcore dynamic. We, for years and years, we exported our inflation into Europe. But okay, let's just say that we start running the printing presses in the United States and we're creating lots and lots more dollars and just passing them out. Let's say that we even back this up with wage and price controls. You still got a euro. If you ever heard of the euro dollar market, mm-hmm. It's Europeans trading in dollars. there's some speculation that goes on there and whatnot, but there's bazillions of dollars in the euro market. And that means that the U.S. currency is still exposed to international pressure. What you're risking by printing all that money instead of taking it from the people who already have it is changing the ratio between dollars in existence and the basket of commodities that they can go out there and chase. And it's already internationalized. It's already internationalized. There's massive exposure in a euro dollar market. So what they're flirting with is hyperinflation, in my opinion. In my opinion, it's too easy. If it's too good to be true, it's probably not true. Modern monetary theory, in my opinion, is too good to be true. Could we use it for a short period of time? Yeah.
I think that's what...
On an emergency basis, like right now, you
right.
know, in the midst of the pandemic.
I think that's what I was kind of getting at, Stan. Like you're I mean, you're part of your prognosis is a stronger state that can offer some of these things. And then the question becomes, well, how do we pay for that? And I was wondering if, you know, you mentioned this short-term stimulus that would come from, you know, under that modern monetary theory. I think its general premises is that deficits are mythological and that if the government has will to do it, they can, and we can provide jobs for everybody, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I think there's a powerful element of magical thinking in that.
Yeah.
And I hesitate to say that because some of the people who support it are like, ooh, I mean, they get very angry if you challenge them on it. And I'm not saying that it can't be used. I'm saying that it can be used on a short-term basis. How short-term a basis, we don't know. It's not an experiment I really want to try. I'm going to say, well, you know, let's just keep pumping dollars out there until all of a sudden the value drops to zero. You know, until we're hauling barrels of money out to buy a loaf of bread kind of thing again.
How would you propose that you would pay for the triage state systems that you're advocating for in Mammon's ecology?
Tax the shit out of the rich. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's it. In a nutshell, tax them. Tax them into non-existence. I'm serious. Nobody needs more than $1 million. No one anywhere ever. Mm-hmm. And I mean, there's a lot of ways to get there, but the first step to getting there is just to increase tax. All we need to do right now is to go back to the same tax code we had in the Eisenhower years, right. Where the wealth tax beyond, well, I forget what the threshold was, but there was a threshold beyond which it was like 75%.
Right.
If you're making $1 million a year, you're going to come up off of about half of that.
Right.
So it could be used for the common good. And that's where I see it. And that way you're not creating more money. The problem right now, see, we're not just in danger from modern monetary theory is not going to be a danger. We've been printing money like this for a while, but we've been printing it for speculators. That's why you have this mountain, and this is what's in the wings right now. And then I'm not the only one saying this. I'm not an economist. I'm, you know, that's why I take everything I say with a grain of salt. I'm not a theologian. I'm not an economist. You know, I'm just this guy who got interested. But right now, there are trillions and trillions of dollars of fictional value out there who are in these bond markets. That if you did release them back out on the economy, it would be catastrophic. What they are is they're giving the people who hold these entitlements incredible power over the rest of us. And they're keeping this thing pumped up because when those bubbles pop, that fictional value exposes itself as a fiction and disappears.
Mm-hmm.
It's not money that corresponds to the creation of some kind of goods. You know, it's not brick and mortar stuff. This is just, it's fantasy money. And when it crashed, the bubble now has gotten bigger than it. It's been reflated to much bigger than it was in 2008. Because Trump, when the first crash hit after COVID hit, Trump immediately dumped, I forget what the amount was, but it was some enormous amount of money back into the hands of speculators, or the whole, you know, what is Michael Hudson? He's an MMT guy. He calls it the real estate, fire economy, finance, insurance, and real estate. Because they're all kind of combined. They're all moving speculative money around and then just sort of creaming it along the way.
Right. The rent economy.
That wraps up another edition of Render Unto Caesar on 91.3 FM CJTR Community Radio. Please join us next time as I conclude my conversation with Stan Goff about the relationship between religion, politics, and the military. Thanks for listening.